I chose as a title the same actually as a paper which came out last week. Good, it doesn't work. And this is one of the authors. The others are William Chuang and Xiaomi Casu. I will be talking about that for, let's say, half of the seminar. The rest will be some early results which I felt would put the paper a bit in context. And I will start with a brief introduction. Here's a sentence which we often hear. It's correct, but in this seminar I will encourage you to think about Keller moduli as symplectic moduli, and you will see why. I apologize for forgetting the umlaut. I will start by defining complex manifolds in a slightly maybe unusual or unfamiliar fashion. Actually, not quite. It's a subclass of complex manifolds which I will be calling complex with k equals 0. As far as I'm concerned, this is just a definition, but those of you who speak French will understand that this is meant to be complex manifolds with a trivial canonical bundle. And the definition is that on the manifold there should be a complex tree form which defines, if you want, a volume form in this way. So, a top form which is nowhere zero, and which is also closed. You can also take this definition and strip it down to its bones by taking away the differential part of it. You will only be left with this, and we express this by saying that the manifold is almost complex. Also, this part has some counterpart, which I'm calling C1 equals 0. And again, you can think this just as a definition. During the seminar, my tongue will slip very often, and I will say complex, but really, I will mean this kind of complex manifold.
Yes. So can you show that these are strictly equivalent conditions to the usual definitions of a complex manifold?
No. I can, with only provided this is also. I can show, so this is equivalent to a complex manifold with a canonical bundle, this is with to another complex manifold with C1 and C2.
I guess I'm confused already. How do I define K if I don't know a priori what
it is? Again, this is a name which I give to a manifold with a. So, anyway, so having said this, now I can answer your question to the second level, which is take your complex tree form to define a normal complex structure. In which way? By saying, sorry for saying this, maybe I should write it. Well, what will be as effective? By saying, my 1-0 forms, for example, are those which are, well, not for example, this defines it. My 1-0 forms are those which, when wedged with omega, annihilated. So this can be taken to just define an almost complex structure. Once you have an almost complex structure, you can define your bundle of P0 forms, and then, well, the very thing that this exists trivializes it. There is an extra subtlety here when I said, so why here? Why did I choose to say k equals 0, not C1 equals 0 here? This takes longer to be explained. Maybe we can talk about it later. The reason I spent some time in reformulating it in this way is that now it's more similar to the definition of a symplectic manifold, which I next give you. So this is a complex two-form, maybe confusingly I also call it J, but it has really two indices down, as always in this talk. And it should also have this property that when wedged three times, when wedged with two other copies of itself, gives something nowhere zero. So again, a kind of volume form. Also, you should require that that this two form is closed. And again, you can take off this differential part of the definition and call the manifold almost symplectic. This is maybe not often heard, but I haven't invented it. Now, if you also impose some compatibility condition between almost complex and almost symplectic, condition I haven't written it, it says that together they define a Riemannian metric, you get what is called an SC3 structure. I won't be talking much about this case here, nor will I be talking much about the case in which you combine the two stronger versions of these definitions. With the compatibility, again, if a manifold is complex and symplectic, it's called the Calabi-Yau. In this talk, we'll mainly consider actually the case in which you combine diagonally weak with strong, strong with weak. And I will also be suggesting that mirror symmetry actually exchanges these two classes. Here is a typical cartoon of what's going on. Here is the largest class of SC3 structure manifolds in which you impose almost nothing. It's all topological conditions. Here, from other side, the origin is this the strongest case, the Calabi-Yau case, and on the axis, I've plotted complex and symplectic manifolds. And if you imagine that the mirror symmetry does this, just flips in this diagram, the Calabi-Yau class is left invariant. Now, why am I saying this? What's the evidence? I didn't completely learn it up. The evidence comes from essentially three sources. The first is the recent classification of n equals 1 vector with Ramon Fizon. And in 2A, schematically, we will see actually shortly how they really look like. These are the equations we'll see, where this exponential of e to the j is the powers are defined. In the exponential, the powers are defined by wedges. In 2B, the equations look exactly the same, but with the e to the j and the omega exchanged. So, this suggests that 2B vector are on this axis and 2A vector are on this axis. Well, e to the ij, if this formal sum of forms is closed, in particular also the two forms closed. Now, another piece of evidence is some direct duality computations which we had made earlier. This formula, the way I'm showing, is not exactly right, but there's one which is right, which is a bit cluttered. We are still working actually on massaging these computations in such a way as to make them more transparent. Here is a sample of the result in the story, and due to group theory, this also is compatible with this moral exchange.
Sorry, I have a question about the first part. So you're not considering NS and S flexes yet.
No, so not in this, not here. Later I will give you formula in which H is also present. Here I was just being lazy or just wanted to give cleaner equations. But still I will be excluding, when I do so, the case in which no Ramon fields are present. So this is when I say all the time, Ramon vector is because I want to exclude that case.
So why do you say vector?
Is this connected with your previous question? Why do I say vector? I call that, okay. So, okay, good. So, see this, I haven't promised you, actually this is the reason for this talk, we'll see it in a second. I haven't promised you that I give you many vector on this and this axis by 10-dimensional supergravity. The second part of this talk will be about really giving this vector with another method, which let's say will involve also corrections. although in an indirect way. What we can really say in a 10-dimensional supergravity is that if they exist, they are here. The equations that I will be presenting are equivalent to the requirements that you get by setting the supersymmetry variations to zero. To get also, as is well known, to get also the equations of motion, you actually have to impose Bianchi by hand. In some cases, it turns out that those are actually implied, but not always. So this is more precisely what I mean. You know, it's just a shorthand for this longer story. Anyway, we'll come back to a more complete form of the equations, and if you're still confused, I encourage you. Please.
Actually, I'm confused about this last statement. So what's the relationship between e to the ij, related to omega and the second statement?
No, I did. Yes, I didn't really promise you to. So here there would be, this is just an equation which looks nice, so I wanted to write it here. But really there are some steps involved in seeing why these two are similar. I can try to summarize what the steps are in two sentences. The difference between these two, aside from this plus or minus, which is maybe not very important, is that here all indices are holomorphic and here two are anti-holomorphic. Oh, I see that from the Mulle. Thank you. Okay, I have an aid in the audience. Which, maybe it's best if this is a bit long. Here, just so impressionistic reasons. Again, I mean, this is just these are just some bullet points. We get back to them in due course. Now, as I was saying, both results have a direct interpretation, so let's say we struggled with both these computations until actually we framed them in the language of generalized computer geometry, in which much of it becomes clearer. And the reason it becomes clearer is not mysterious, is that generalized computer geometry has as its main raison d'être, its main reason of existence, to be a definition which includes a special cases, complex manifolds and symplectic manifolds. This talk is not really about generalized computer geometry, so you shouldn't expect from me a review of this. I understand Hitchin did this during last month, but I will give you an idea of how this definition comes about and why is it useful. Anyway, I consider it as a third bullet point just because the fact that there is a more general concept which includes both symplectic and complex manifolds as special cases might be viewed as also an evidence of sorts for the exchange between these two axes. Now, as I was answering to Sergei, for all I said about results about 10-dimensional supergravity, those didn't really, at least not so far, but we are working on it, give, let's say, non-stupid examples. There are some examples, but they aren't, in my opinion, too interesting. They could have been gotten in other ways. And we want to produce interesting ones. So rather than considering 10-dimensional supergravity, which presents some problems, we turn to another method. We started from Calabiau, Vecchia, and then we used the transitions which only preserve one of the two conditions. So in 2A, they will give us symplectic manifolds, and on 2B, complex manifolds. Now, you might be perplexed because usually the transitions we use are between a Calabiau and another Calabiau, what allows the transitions that we are considering to exist is the presence of Raman flux on the initial Calabiau. Mm-hmm. This part is actually just a generalization of an easy generalization of work done by Polchinski and Stominger, we will see. The resulting vacuum that we get, so what we do is to interpret those vacuum and to see that they even though they are not vacuum which you could see from second dimension supergravity alone, they still confirm this picture that I have shown you before. And moreover, by construction, by the way we consider them, by the way we constructed them, they come in mirror pairs. So let me now outline a plan for the rest of this talk. First, I will review the evidence I told you about. Then I will construct this vacuum, just theoretical, let's say. And then I will give the geometrical interpretation that I was just talking about. And I will also speculate on what are the consequences for the general picture, some of which I have already sketched. Let's start with the review of the previous evidence. So the first point is the conditions for preserved n equals 1 supersymmetry in 10-dimensional supergravity with Raman distance from 0. In 2A, as you see here, there is also flux, but not only flux. These are the equations in 2B. They are similar. And these are some notations. For us, here, you might have wondered what this blue symbol was. For us, you should think phi plus just being the e to the ij that we were seeing before, and phi minus will be omega. F is a combination of all the Raman fluxes in all degrees, and A and B are just some normalizations which clutter the equations. Now, as I said, these are equivalent to the conditions on preserved n equals 1 supersymmetry.
What is F? F is the total
Raman. F is the total Raman, so it's just really saying to be F1 plus F3 plus F5, where these are forms. In case you're thinking, what does it mean to, well, you're not thinking it, but in case someone is thinking, what does it mean to put here a formal sum of forms of different degrees? Well, so is the case for phi plus, for example. So all these equations are meant to be equations which have.
That would be 0 to 10 and 2b, 1.
These are only internal, actually. They also determine the external ones with equivalence. These are those which really have only legs internally.
Oh, you're assuming the internal space is 6 dimensions.
So this is Minkowski. No, sorry. Minkowski, or. Well, as I have written Minkowski, I can also write the case with that. De Sitter, science, world science, well, the working is this, okay? A six-dimensional.
The star is the internal.
The star is the internal. Also, these equations are valid a little more generally, as we'll see in the next slide. If you work it out, there is just a an exchange, a mirror map, which sends the first set of equations to the second. Well, I mean, you can see already that they are very symmetrical. All changes is the sign of plus of phi from one equation to the other. For the case of
So these are equations. Yes. What are these are the equations for the existence of
These equations are equivalent to the setting to zero the Gravitino variations and the Dilatino variations. You use them all, you mix them, actually, so you prove them, and then you go back and prove that actually they were equivalent. Then you have to impose the Bianchi identities, but what is nice, what is nice is that the Bianchi equations, the Bianchi identities actually are not so different because they, in this notation in which all forms are found, they would just look like a D plus H wedge on the sum of the Fs. And indeed, in some of the cases, that it so happens that the Bianchi identities are actually implied, something which is a bit surprising, at least for me.
And you also have to impose DH equals 0?
Yes.
Settled.
You're right, I shouldn't be saying Bianchi. No. DH equals 0 has to be imposed separately. In particular, if you work a bit, you show that these have consequences. So you might actually wonder why one bothers to express everything in this form, if then you can get easier results. Well, one of the reasons is this formal similarity between the 2A and 2B equations, but another is the following. Now consider the case we are considering so far is one in which there is a C3 structure on the manifold. In other words, the tangent bundle has a C3 transition function. The same will then be true for P star, and, sorry for being long-winded, then on SC3 times SC3. On T plus P star, you will have an SC3 times SC3 structure. The reason I took the pain to go here is that this, however, can happen more generally. Namely, rather than having a C3 structure here and a C3 structure here, you can have a C3 times SC3 on the whole thing, and there will be, well, two sub-bundles which will have a C3 structure, but they will be oblique in T plus T star. What this means for us is that phi plus becomes something more general than into the IJ, and phi minus becomes more general than just omega. They will have, at this point, this will be, again, a formal sum of forms of even degrees, but they will not all be related in this simple fashion, and the phi minus will also have one form degree and five form degrees.
You say this can happen more generally, you mean that you can find supersymmetric
solutions? No, so far this is just a geometrical statement. Having said this, there are simple cases in which it really happens. For some reason, I don't think they are terribly interesting, but...
it happens that you're describing supersymmetric solutions, or you're describing some other kind of solutions, or they're not even...
No, here this is just some statement about the structure. So here there's no... below this line, there's no derivative.
Right, yeah, I'm just trying
I haven't imposed it yet. You could.
What can happen when it happens? What is the physical significance?
What does this question mean? Well, what is the physical significance of?
Structure, what's the broader context? How does it fit in the solutions? Is it 2A or 2B?
Okay, I don't know. One way of answering your question, but it won't satisfy you, is that. So these are actually among the stupid examples I was talking about. If you take a solution which of the original equation, so for with e to the j and omega, and suppose that there is actually an isometry, so that you can do the duality, there's an isometry which is also compatible with the spin, of course, you will end up with another solution, and the way you could do your spin-off computations without ever having heard of me, but the way that solution, the T-dual, will fit into this picture is in the following way. So thanks for asking the question. Phi plus and phi minus will not be in this form, but for example, phi plus will be in this form in which there is a you see, it's an exponential in four of the six directions, and a complex form in the other two. So it's a mix of these two cases. See, bad.
Okay. So little I is the square root of minus 1 and little j is a 2-form?
Little j because it's a lead, I mean it's only in four directions.
And the I's are not summed great.
What do you mean? So it so happens that what I was going to say next fits what you were asking. This will, so by t-duality, this guy will go to this.
I guess an important point is that all the equations that he showed for e to the ij and omega are valid for 5 plus and 5 minus. So the equations that he showed before wouldn't change.
But they would have no meaning, right?
Why not?
So what would be 5 plus and 5 minus?
See? If you guys wait. Okay. What do you mean by they wouldn't have no meaning, any meaning?
Previously you had equations, I mean, I'm still just reiterating the questions C was asking. Previously you had equations for supersymmetry, where phi plus and phi minus were some combinations of Gannon matrices and spinors, right? I mean, all of
exactly
this...
Exactly the same here.
You don't need to know anything about spinors. You can hear I take care of spinors. And then you like spinors, but I don't know. Let's say I don't. We can, from now on, you can forget about spinors and think about differential forms. These are some of the differential forms, the phi plus and phi minus, which satisfy certain algebraic conditions. Which ones? The ones I sketched. So that together they will describe this SCT tensor-SCT structure. Look, I understand that this wasn't meant to be a review of generalized complex geometry, so I understand that there are many points which aren't covered. The spirit, I hope, is clear. Again, these two together describe this. So they can't be just two differential, some sort of differential forms chosen randomly. They have some conditions. They will obey some a certain mathematical property, algebraic, just mathematical, an overkill. Namely, both will be pure spinors on T plus C star. And this thing, so then there will be a compatibility condition. This condition of being a pure spinor will just, so when you said now we come back to spinors, this condition is precisely implied by the way you just told me to construct the files.
The question is it implied the other way around? If I'm having the most general possible
pair, if you have the most general pair with a certain compatibility condition that I will tell you, you can go back and express phi plus and phi minus as those. This is an excellent question. I understand now why you
I think that was the question Stephen.
Okay. No, I understand. So let me reformulate it. So you might say, wait a minute. Here, if you solve with two with a pair phi plus and phi minus, which you have taken in a book, let's say, and if you are not sure that they come from spinors, how do you know that you can go back that they are relevant for supersymmetry? And okay. And my answer is, again, if you have a pair and they have a certain compatibility condition, yes, you will be able to. So let's say, when I said that they were equivalent, I also meant this. You really, I guess, on that page I didn't detail the algebraic condition. So really the supersymmetry equations have two parts. One which is entertaining, which you were seeing on the slide, and another which is maybe a bit more boring, which is an algebraic part, which is what you're talking about now.
What are you saying? There's some kind of quadratic equation like phi plus guaranteeing that it's a pure spinner. If it's satisfied, then you can say that these equations really give you a solution of the delay.
There's the quadratic equation you just talked about, and then there's also compatibility between the two, which right now I don't see quite clearly whether it can be reformulated in a quadratic. I prefer the linear form of the Dirichlet. If I use the linear form, the compatibility condition is obvious.
And if we impose this compatibility condition on phi plus and phi minus and take it as a solution,
then yes.
Do you really get outside of the class of these phi's which come from J and omega? Or this compatibility condition will force us to, I mean, all solutions that we find still don't be expressed in terms of J and omega?
Well, here's a solution which, what I just said is that there are cases which are not expressed in terms of J and omega, but in terms of this more general garbage. You still see some J of sorts and some.
Right, because in this example.
No, here I gave you only one, right? There will be another which will be. So in the four dimensions, will be like a compass form, and then in these two directions will be an exponential.
We don't have too many examples of generalized complex geometry.
Yes.
That's part of the problem.
But
that's part of the problem.
That's right. If you're asking, does it have to be, the answer is probably not, although no, not too many explicit examples are known.
But probably not. We can do it with a pencil and paper without, you know, complicated examples or anything like that. You can just look at compatibility conditions that he's talking about. Then
so you're asking the local questions.
Yeah.
Are there local solutions? Absolutely.
Which are
also, I mean,
a class where we can express everything in terms of J and omega.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's
a bigger class. Well, in a way, there is also a global one. I mean, the phi plus that take any collabial with chi equals zero. It will have a bi vector which has no zeros, and you can write phi plus in this form.
Look, his answer is really, it's really the same, right? I was talking about the case in which the structure is stupid, like it's a torus, and he was, let's say, I was talking about torus, and he was talking about Rn. They really are the same. It's really the same kind of example that you can give. You see, in fact, you can also globalize it. Locally, yes, but and then you can also globalize it in these cases that I was talking, was calling stupid. I call them stupid because they have too much structure, let's say, too little structure. So here, a priori, you shouldn't be asking for more than just, for example, a two-form or a three-form. So, in other words, you shouldn't be asking for more than this structure for supersymmetry. Those examples give you a reduction which is too much less to a trivial bundle. So T plus this R becomes trivial.
So let me see if I understand. Hopefully I'm not being stupid. So let's suppose
hopefully,
that I have a phi plus and a phi minus that will be general things that satisfies the compatibility condition. How do I go backwards from that to the solution of the supergravity equation? Because here, if it is e to the ij and omega, then I know what those are. I know that j is the related to the, basically the k of the problem. I know that omega is
so you would like really
related to the spinner and so on. But how do I?
How often when solving a supersymmetric equation, so you really give the spino a solution in the form. Here is the spino, first component, second component, third component. Typically you just...
He wants to know if you solve the supergravity equations or not.
Yeah. And I said I did.
In a general sense.
Well, okay, but you got to tell me what procedure is to actually exhibit the solution. So say I give you a phi plus and a phi minus, you have to give me whatever, an H, a metric,
okay, good. So then, yeah, there is a procedure for. So in this geometry, there is a procedure to give you also. So okay, good. At some point, I said that the compatibility condition in the SCT structural case, in the case in which the phi plus and phi minus are like this, the compatibility condition is exactly that they define together a Riemannian metric. Good. The compatibility condition that I was talking about here, in this case, is that they define together a Riemannian metric and a B field. And there is a construction to give them.
And those are a Riemannian metric and a B field satisfying the two gravity equations along with the remote fields.
Yes, because of the work we did. Good. I feel comments on the lowest lines here is useless due to our discussion. Now, so this is a bird's eye view. So we now go to the second piece of evidence, which is still being under massage, because these are all the results which are now we are now recasting in this language. So what we did was to assume just that there is a T3 vibration, a special Lagrangian T3 vibration, and define accordingly J and omega. Then by dualizing the torus, we get a dual J and omega on the new manifold. And it will follow, a map will follow between DJ and the omega and their counterparts on the dual manifold. Why are we doing this? Because we want to, the map between this and this wouldn't at all be obvious a priori. These quantities really characterize how much a manifold is far from being a Calabiao, given that if both are zero, if they are both zero, then we have a Calabiao. And so people have been considered the quantities such as these. You take DJ in the contact with the tree form, or you take the 2-1 and primitive part of DJ. And we would like to see where they go. If you dream up something like this, just that J and omega exchange, of course you run into trouble. Well, what are these expressions going to? Everything becomes clearer if you use actually if it, the IJ and omega. The reason is that it's very similar to the answer I just gave to him. When you trivialize, in that case we saw that the structure of the spin of the phi completely changed. A form, a differential form, will not go necessarily to a differential form. Let me make this clearer, because you might be surprised by this exchange. The form along the torus will become a vector. In the dual torus. And this is roughly speaking why you shouldn't expect that the degree of the form goes to the same degree on the other side. What we are using, maybe I should rephrase it, to deal with these strange things in which vectors go to forms and vice versa, we are using just the fact that, GNS complex geometry uses T plus T star as its basic object, and this is left invariant by t-duality. If this exchange looks familiar, it's because it should be in the context of planes on Calabiaus. It already appeared with in some actually corrected form. Now, here is the description the answer to this question which emerges. You should, rather than considering these quantities, you should consider some more difficult looking ones, but which require more work to define, but actually then transform in a very simple way. So once I define them in this way, I stick each of those in a certain Hodge diamond, which I call pure Hodge diamond because it's not the usual Hodge diamond. Here, for example, doesn't have one, but this sum of forms of different degrees. Then the action of T-duality, of these three T-dualities, will be simply to rotate the diamond. So, after all, it's simple. So, the moral of the story is that if you consider this pair, near symmetry, or I should call it at this stage, three T-dualities become, the action of these three T-dualities become much more manifest. All this was meant as a first part, and the second part is about these transitions that we use to actually produce this record whose existence I was complaining about, whose lack of existence I was complaining about before. For that, I will quickly review for you the case in which a transition is between a Calabi-Yau and another Calabi-Yau. Suppose that I will consider mainly the 2B case, and whenever it's needed, I will comment about 2A. Suppose we have a point in which n in a compass moduli space in which n tricycles shrink, and suppose they also satisfy R relations in homology. I should say at this stage that I want these R relations to involve all of the tricycles. I will keep this assumption for the rest of the talk, although dropping it would actually go in my favor. So it's for the sake of simplicity. In this case, I remind you this is the spectrum. And there are, when you get to the singular point in which this entry cycle shrink, we'll know that there will be n new masses hypermultiplets. They will be charged under these vectors. But so the charge matrix would look like it's a square matrix, but really the charge matrix has a kernel of dimension R due to the R relations in homology. Now, if you look at the conditions for n equals 2 vector to exist, it's a kind of Stern equation, you will see that if this has a kernel, you can just assign what are the values for this and solve for B. This gives a new vector, which are n equals 2, and in which the expectation value for the new Bain hypermultiplet is non-zero. We want to know what is the 10-dimensional interpretations of this, and for this, of this vector, and for this we let's first count the spectrum. Due to the Higgs mechanism, n minus r of these vectors are gone. As for the hypers, also n minus r are gone, but we had previously gained the n BAs, so the net result is this. Now, how does this help us? Well, it helps us because it fits the a mathematical construction. What is the construction? Well, it's called transition, and it consists in replace the three cycles with two cycles. From the topological point of view, which is what I will consider in this slide, it's just called surgery. For the rest of this talk, the original manifold with before the transition will be called M6 without a tilde, and the one after the transition will be denoted with a tilde. Now becomes some cartoon. Rather than dryly give you the result of what I want to do at this stage is just to compute the cohomology of the manifold after we do this. We replace the three cycles with the two cycles and check if possibly matches with the counting of hypers and vectors that we just did. So I wanted to illustrate it a bit. In particular, in the case in which you have no relations, one notices that only H to 1 changes. This might be a bit confusing because we are maybe used to think that, in this cartoon, NS3 is represented by NS1, and NS2 by NS0, which is simply 2 points. So we are several dimensions lower. So you might be confused because we are used to think that in the usual transition, you replace NS3 with NS2. So what's going on? Well, that intuition comes from the non-compact case. In the compact case, really, the S0 that you create in this way is trivial, as this cartoon shows. It's bounded by something. But what if there are relations? In that case, you do gain an element. In this cartoon, it would be an element in H0. What is meant to help you think about is H2 in the six-dimensional case. If you collect this impressionistic... So this can be really made into solid arguments, and in general, the results will look like this. But now this agrees with the counting on the multiples we saw before. This is still not enough, because this is just a topological computation. How do we know that on the other side it's reasonable to have a vacuum? Well, in this case it just happens that you can ask whether the manifold after the transition is Calabi-Yau, and the answer is that whenever there are relations, actually the answer is yes. So due to the specifications I gave you in the previous slide, actually in this case we will have a Calabi-Yau. Given all these considerations, it's now natural to say that simply the new branch is type 2B theory on a new Calabi-Yau, which we get in this topologically in this way, and for some deeper reasons also from the point of view of differential geometry can be made into a Calabi-Yau. I want now, after this intermezzo, I want now to...
Sorry, do you always have to have relations? So what happens when we have no relations?
That's what you are going to see now. The first order answer is, on the other side, you won't have a Calabi-Yau. So it will look like, actually, we don't have any vacuum. In that case, there are no spikes leaving from there, no new branches. But in presence of fluxes, all these changes. Let us to fix ideas. So I'm really thinking just that there are no relations, but to fix ideas, maybe I thought we'd be talking about the case in which there is only one cycle. Call it A1, which shrinks. In that case, here's why you should be worried. Well, not only because actually of the mathematical result I just talked about, which is that there are no Calabi-Yaus on the other side, but also the field theoretical computation gives you this equation to have a new vector. And this implies that B equals 0. But if you switch on flux, everything changes. What happens is the following. So let's switch it along the dual cycle B1. First of all, there's a contribution to the potential. Previously, there was a modular space of vacua. Now the flux, not surprisingly, gives a potential on this modular space. And if you roll on this potential, what happens is that you are driven to the point in which the cycle A1 shrinks, and that's actually why it chose such a flux in the first place. Now, something changes. At the point in which at which you are driven by this potential, still there is a new hyper. But this time, it so happens that there is also a contribution from the flux. This equation is completely modified. Now it can have a vacuum in which B is equal to something. Notice that it also contains hyper phi Helio. This guy is the combination of F terms and D terms. The hyper combination of them. This is because we are in n equals to supergravity.
So where is, how do you explain the right hand side? How did you get that?
Okay. This is because, actually I will get to that also later, but in two words maybe. In two words, maybe you recognize it already. So these terms here also tell you whether that there is a gauging in the theory, who is charged under what. And as you know, there is a Chern-Simons term which makes the universal hyper charge under the vector corresponding to the A1 cycle. And this thing that I put into zero also happens to be a moment, the moment map, right? The term is like a moment map for those gaugings. So this is in two words, in some sense I will get deeper into that later. Not much deeter though. But apparently we can discuss.
You're not searching on any H flux, right?
No. I don't want it because I would give contributions to the tuple. So we better forget it here. So what am I doing now? The result is this has been done in the paper by Polchinski, done in the Strominger, which also first found this fact that fluxes give rise to gaugings. The example they gave a speculation that the new branch might be what the new branch actually, let's not spoil, might be, but we're not really talking about the case they were talking about. We think has some problems, which so we don't really know how to give an interpretation to the original case. We can, however, here we have modified their prescription and in some easy way, in such a way that we can now go on and use mathematical results. Now let's do the same as what we saw for the Calabi-Yau case. There's now. Since there is now a new branch, let's see what happened to the something of the multiplex. The vectors, one becomes, in this particular case, one becomes massive. And of the hypers, we had gained again a B, but we have still to take into account the Higgs effect, so a combination of it with the universal hyper we give rise to one massless hyper and one massive, one which is massive. And the net result from the massless ones is here, so they're lost on here. But I want you also to keep in mind those which have got a mass. We'll see in a second why. Let's first start with the topological counting. It was this, right? I mean, that computation was simply topological, so it didn't matter whether we were talking about the Calabi-Yau or not. For r equals 0, which is the case we are considering, it would agree with the counting we just did. So there is some, you might start thinking that might be, the new vacuum might be geometrical after all. Well, also another thing, which is what we have engineered, is that this the modification is only it's reasonable to think that the modification to the manifold is only local around the cycle which has shrunk, as opposed to cases in which, for example, so this is the initial Polchinski Strominger case. There are cases in which it's a whole volume of N6 which shrinks due to quantum corrections, the whole quantum volume of N6. In that case, it's not clear what should happen on the other side if there is any topological modification you can think of. The manifold really disappears, and then God knows what's on the other side. But in the cases we are talking about here, so in 2B, it's really without any other assumptions. The Calabiau, it's reasonable to think that Calabiau, away from the cycle which shrinks, really doesn't care about what's happened. What happened. Now, well, in 2A, this is less obvious due to this might happen, but there are definitely cases in which there's a point in the Kähler moduli space, which yeah, I'm calling symplectic, in which only one curve shrinks. In that case, you can also say that the effect might be simply localized. Again, we will switch on a certain flux, which will drive the Calabiau to that point. And, for example, I mean, we have found that one example, but we expect there to be many. Why? Because, this thing, to check whether there are curves which shrink is completely under control. There are methods which are very well developed to check these things. Now, this time, I mean, it really works just the same as here, with the appropriate exchange, and it's again okay for R equals 0. So this was all topology. Now we should really see. I've been trying to convince you that on the other side there will be a manifold. Implicitly, well, I really said that the topology was given by this surgery, replacing three cycles with two cycles. They cannot be Calabiau because of what I told you before. More generally, here's a salad of results from the literature which says the following. In the case in which you replace a three-sphere with a two-sphere, if the initial manifold was complex, it will stay so. If it was symplectic, it won't whenever there are no relations. And notice the two results. Only for the two results are exchanged in the 2A. Sorry. You really get that the role of complex and symplectic is exchanged. If you consider S2 as opposed to NS2 as opposed to NS3. Shrinking. Here's the reason. Here's the reason this happens. The S2 which you have created as exemplified by the cartoon is holomorphic but trivial in homology. So, if you have integrate just the dj over the b which bounds the S2, you will get the volume of the S2 which is non-zero. So, if we now apply these results to our case in which M6, the initial manifold is actually Calabiau, sorry, here there shouldn't be a tilde, this is the original manifold. Then, on the other side, now M6 tilde will be. So there are these theorems which tell us that it will be naturally complex but not symplectic, and naturally symplectic but not complex. So we are led to the result I told you at the beginning. There are the IQR, which are complex and non-symplectic. Non-scalar if you want in type 2b, and symplectic but not non-scalar in type 2a. Well, due to more time than I thought spent on the generalized complex geometry part, I'll now fly. I will just mention to you that there is another kind of check that you could do. I told you to remember the massive multiplets. And I want now to check whether we can reconstruct this massive multiplets on the other side. This was the other kind of check we wanted to do. This slide is to tell you that this check is not guaranteed to work at all. This vector that we reconstructed are not expected just to be found by in 10 dimensional supergravity alone. On the other side, you have some small, even though homologically trivial, cycle. There might be very well be stringy corrections. Nevertheless, we carried on, and what we found, here's the moment map I was talking about. You should think of this P as a, in the region limit, as a kind of superpotential. What we found is that really the role, so this is something which determines the gaugings in the two sides. In the original side, it's more or less folklore that a flux gives rise to a gauging. On the other side, it's DJ, really, which gives rise to a gauging. This is very well understood, can be expanded using harmonic forms. This is less clear. The prescription which we used is in a series of papers by Jan Lui and collaborators, and Walden and collaborators. And it's the following. As I said at the beginning, J and omega together define a metric. You use that to expand, find massive eigenforms. Then, due to this fact, you will know how D acts on a given mass level. If the mass level contains or is non-degenerate, you will get something like this. And then you can use it in this expression and get something in terms of these new multiplets, scalars. You might be confused because this, which I said, which I said to be the generating function for the gaugings, seems to be zero. Fortunately, it's a stupid question. Actually, the omega is zero only on the vacuum. So here is the final feature that we get. On the original Calabiau, there is a vacuum precisely where the x1, one of the vectors, the scalars and the vector multiplet, is zero, that represents the locus where the cycle shrinks. On the other side, the vacuum is really where this extra guy here disappears, leaving an omega which is closed. And this was my first definition. This is a complex manifold with k equals zero. And I argued, this was the conjecture that, exactly the conjecture that the vacuum is there for a complex non-scalar manifold. Something similar happens for the hyper. One last thing that I want to say is that although we used it, this method requires some guessing about the spectrum of Laplacian, which is based on some papers, but we are not sure it can be applied to our case. And more importantly, what is this guy here? Does it have some more profound interpretation? We want to propose, although you shouldn't take this proposal maybe too seriously, it's really to raise the question, that DJ should be thought of as an element in a relative cohomology with respect to the two spheres that you have created. It will look like these two spheres just random, but it's actually, so that it can be shrunk. It's actually...
An element of relative cohomology is a pair.
Yeah, it's a pair. It's a DJ comma zero. Yeah, I should have written that. In the paper, it's better written. So here I actually wrote a pair for functional dual to DJ comma zero. And also that when we are away from a vacuum, there will be something similar for the omega. With some manipulations, it really looks like this guy becomes like a linking number between these two. Here's a picture, just in case. The S2 and the S3, well, it's a... And actually, you will see immediately that S3 and S2 link in this case, because one is zero dimension, but try to imagine this in higher dimension. There are some computations where did they seem to suggest this. Another thing which might be interesting is to use this to... So really the initial point about all these transitions was Reed's fantasy back in the 80s. The analogy on which it was based was the realization by Kodaira. I believe that all the... So mathematicians were seeing 19-dimensional modular spaces of algebraic K3s. I'm not sure that probably they weren't called that way at the time. And then Kodai realized that the reason they had so similar properties was that they were really sitting in a larger modular space, in a larger space, the space of K3s. Reed wanted to suggest that there's something similar for trifolds. We want to ask whether this is actually realized in string theory. This looks like just name dropping, but what we mean is that some of the fields, what we mean is really all these computations we have done with massive multiples, they look, there are some massive states which are more special than the others. And these massive states would be those which bring you, which make up together with the modular spaces the larger space which would be the analog of this. This is even crazier than a fantasy, so let me rush to conclusions. This is what I want to bring back home. String theory has vacua on complex or symplectic manifolds, which in a way answers this question, in an indirect way if you want. Remarkably, they follow the same patterns which were suggested by supergravity, the picture in which vacua were on the two axes. And mirror symmetry still holds for this new vacua, although they are not Calabiao, but only complex in 2B and symplectic in 2A. Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question about this complex and symplectic.
First point.
N equal 1 supersymmetry always has a Taylor structure.
Oh, I see. You mean some modular space?
Yeah. If you have a low energy n equal 1 supersymmetry, then there's always a description in terms of a Taylor.
Yeah, but that's on the modular space. Here I'm really talking about the manifold, the manifold itself.
It's not...
Is there any reason for them to be related? So, okay. In the Calabiao with flux case, even though there are no vacua other than those in which the Calabiao is actually singular, there is still a special Kähler structure, on the vector modular space. And the reason really is due to the fact that you can gauge while keeping the n equals to structure. This is the magic of gauge supergravity theories. Now, here, the idea, and I believe this is what confuses you, is that, this isn't what we have done. This is a picture which comes from this paper by Jan Louis and other people, who claim Well, to some extent, the claim is actually clear, to some others it's not, that to have an inquest 2 supersymmetry in the action, simply in the action, just in the CT structure, the weakest of my definitions here. There's something, I mean, really loose, topological. Why is that? I expect I want to be surprised about this claim. Just because if you have so a CT structure can be rephrased by having an internal spinor, which has zeros nowhere. If you have that spinor, you can plug it into the 10-dimensional, you can write down an answer, so the composition 4 plus 6, plug that answer in the supergravity transformations in 10 dimensions, and out come your supersymmetry transformations in 4 dimensions. Well, that's not really a proof, but these people claim worked more. Not only this, but also they claim that still an inquest to supergravity with the expression for the gaugings that we used. And lots of other things that I'm not talking about. There are many questions about those papers. The part which the author, I think it's fair to say, the author of the last of the paper which gives title to this seminar, found the least attractive is that you have to know how to assign a special role to some massive fields rather than others. Now, in some situation, this might be set by the geometry of your manifold. If for some reason your manifold has been... So there are ways to engineer... there are some ways to engineer your manifold in such a way that it has a very small... your first argument value of the Laplacian is very small and the others are huge. There are some ways to do this. So in that situation, you might say, oh, okay, I look, I believe to Jan Lewis. It would be best if one didn't have to do these tricks with separations of scales. After all, you know very well that this is not what we do, and not even in for ADS reductions. So I'm not sure my answer satisfied you, but that's all I have in stock.
I hope you'll give a quick answer. It's getting late.
This is a difficult question, though.
Yeah, okay, did you look at whether this manifold provides vacuum for 11 dimensional supergravity going to 5 dimensions?
No. So thanks. it's a good day. So have a day.